Today we're discussing the history, the power, and the corruption of the College of Cardinals. We're going to talk about its origin, where did it come from, and all the way up to this modern day, and with this new structure that Pope Francis has instituted, the C9, the Council of the College of Cardinals. These nine men that have come together recently in this past week, three have been removed, so we're now down to a C6. We're going to talk about some of that news, but first off, we're just going to begin with the history of what is a cardinal. I'm joined today with my co-host, Timothy Gordon.
All right, how are you, Tim, doing?
So you've got a bunch of facts on modern contemporary cardinals. We're going to be looking at a lot of the cardinals that were appointed by Pope John Paul II and how we got to this time where we have cardinals saying all kinds of crazy things, right?
Yeah. I mean, the defense on this has traditionally been like, well, all of the bad cardinals that we currently have that are extant in the College of Cardinals, of course, were JP2 because he had such a long pontificate, et cetera, et cetera. We'll talk about this in terms of the chronology of when some of these bad guys came in. So were they late in the JP2 pontificate, when, i.e. when he was, when we have the worm tongue problem, maybe, or maybe the worm tongue defense, depending on how you look at it, as you called it. So it actually is an interesting little peek. I went through just consistory by consistory all, I think, 10 of JP2s, and just picked out the bad names from each one, and the really bad names, even leaving off quite a few. So
what's crazy about it, I want to get into the history first, but just for people watching, to hang on with us here. What's crazy about it is a lot of the bad apples that we know by name nowadays came from the early consistories of John Paul II. Which makes the worm, we should call it the worm tongue hypothesis that we talked about a couple shows back. The worm tongue hypothesis is this, that John Paul II is rock solid, awesome guy. And as he aged and had Parkinson's disease and just got older and frail, the men around him as advisors, like Worm Tongue with Théoden King and Lord of the Rings, were just giving him lies, right?
Yeah.
Doing things around his back and manipulating court so that these sinister things could be happening in the church, and he didn't know about it or couldn't do anything about it. That's the worm tongue thesis that I think most of us have been taught when we say, well, why was Bernardine a cardinal for so long under John Paul II saying and doing all these things? The worm tongue thesis.
That was at his second consistory ever, very early in his
pontificate. Bernardine.
Mm-hmm. To be fair, more of the bad guys came out of the later. You know, there are a lot at the 9th and 10th consistory. So that it might be partly true, but it's a partial truth at best. We'll talk about it later. I just want to point out the C9 is down to the C6. I think I tweeted this out yesterday. Get your rim shot ready. We need to get rid of two more of these guys so it can be the C4 to show how explosive
this pontificate
the situation
is
in the church.
That's right. C4 in the Vatican.
It's just a just a cheesy one-liner, but let's see if we can go down a few more and maybe get to the C0. Might be our hypothesis today. Anyway, you got the research on
cardinals.
Why we have it at all. Yeah, and cardinals in general.
So I'm basically lifting this from a book I wrote. It's called The Eternal City. This is a book that I taught in Rome to seminarians for 3 summers. And it's basically the theology of Rome. Why are we not Jerusalem Catholics? You would think Jesus died and rose again in Jerusalem. Holy Spirit came to Jerusalem. The Pope should be in Jerusalem. Like, that's where it all started, right? But it's not. The Pope's in Rome. And we're Roman Catholic. And we see Rome as the mother and teacher of all the faithful. So this book is a theology of that. It looks at the prophecies of Daniel, the New Testament, the Hebrew prophets, and explains why it is that the church is in Rome. And in that book, I discuss the development of the Church of Rome, including the office of cardinal. Now, originally in the church, the Pope was elected by the clergy of Rome.
Right.
They voted. That was the guy. Usually he himself was of the Diocese of Rome and was promoted from within. That's just early church. That's patristic church. In the 6th century, though, this is the 500s, in Rome, the first technical cardinals were the 7 deacons of the 7 regions of the city of Rome. And it was the deacons, not the priests, who had immediate access to the Pope in Rome. And this is why, by the way, we mentioned yesterday when we were talking about the death penalty and why the deacons wear the dalmatic. It's because the Pope could wear the dalmatic because he was imperial. He was granted to wear the dalmatic. And then he allowed the deacons to wear the dalmatic because they were so closely tied to the person of the Pope, the seven deacons of Rome. The priests wore the chasuble, which is the lower grade. And the priests always hate to hear this, like, oh, no, trust me. The chasuble is more of a street outfit. It's a more common one. The dalmatic is imperial. So technically, the deacon wears the higher vestment because of his proximity to the Pope. And then that custom then over time spread throughout the rest of Christendom. Now in the 8th century, the term cardinal is attached to the senior priest of every titular church in Rome. Now, titular is just has a title. That means basically the bishop has titled it to be an official church. So basically every pastor and every deacon at this point is now a cardinal. And the term cardinal comes from Latin, and it means a hinge, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a key, a pivotal. It's like the same thing as pivotal, it pivots. So if something's pivotal, like everything turns on that. So these cardinals are incardinated, as we say in canon law. That means you've been incorporated into the pivot of the church.
Right.
Makes sense?
Yeah, like a linchpin. Important moving piece. Yeah. For sure.
Also, it's interesting, Tim, the old, I'm all things Latin, I love Latin, the old pre-Vulgate Bible referred to altars as titulus in the Bible.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't know it if you've gone to church in the 80s and 90s, like a lot of people our age.
Right.
That the altar is like the center of the mat, isn't it? The priest breakdancing on the altar, but on stage with the spotlight.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the old Latin, pre-Jerome, like when, I think it's when Jacob, you know, anoints the rock where when they erect altars, it's a titulus. So this idea of a titular church means it has an altar that is blessed and recognized by the local bishop.
Interesting.
It's deep, you know, it's cool.
Yeah.
Now the Lateran Council of 769 said that only the cardinal priests and the cardinal deacons were eligible to become popes. Now, that's no longer the case, right?
No, yeah.
So, at this time, laity are definitely not making any votes, and no one could come in and intervene. It was just those people. That's like our first canonical decree.
Well, this is also, so it's corresponding with what's happening in the Holy Roman Empire. Remember, there's like a 30-year period. I think it begins in 769. I'm going to have to check on that. It's either 769 or 770 when Charlemagne, you know, heir of the Carolingian dynasty, comes in and really starts taking things over for his father, Pippin the Short. And, of course, Pippin the Short's father is Charles Martel, the Hammer, who stopped the Muslims from taking over all of Europe, the Battle of Tours, you know, decades before this. So the Carolingian dynasty is legit. Charlemagne is going to basically come into office over the course of these 30 years. His papacy is known for being kind of like, emperorship is known as being kind of like Constantine plus. He called himself Second Constantine, Constantine Reborn. And he, in a benign way, or in a manner where he had the best of intentions, he's known for, his rule is offset by, I should say, interfering in the church affairs. He loved the church. He was a loyal son of the church, even more than Constantine was just sort of, benevolent toward the church. But Charlemagne, who wants to be second Constantine, who wants to start this second period of, you know, Pax Romana, he really interferes with the church. And so there's a lot happening right around this time that does involve the conclaves of lay investiture, people, rich, you know, patrician families in Rome, and meaning laity and aristocrats called the patricians, that would interfere with church politics by getting their guy. This did not begin with like the Borgias 600 years later. This is something that is important to Charlemagne, central figure of the whole period, on his way up. And he's only crowned on January 1st, 800, 30 years later.
But he becomes king of the Franks in 768. And the Lateran Council that says only the priest and deacon can vote is 769, the very next year.
Got it.
This is when we first see armed guards at papal elections. So everything just said is totally legit.
Yeah. Nice.
There's probably a fear on both sides of the political and ecclesiastical spectrum that, wow, now that we have someone so powerful, like a new Constantine in the church, we need to set out the rules here.
Right.
The conclaves, you know,
right.
Need some armed guards, you know, let's make sure that we know exactly who can vote and who can't.
Yeah.
So that Roman patricians don't, you know, strike back at the Franks, or the Franks don't weasel in and strike back at the Romans or whatever.
Darn tootin'. I mean, it's important because people look at what's going on, the corruption of our day in the church, and they essentially harbor this attitude. It might have been bad before, which we agree with, but it's worse now, which we also agree with. But they don't seem to understand that things like the Sankt Gallen Mafia, who we've talked a lot about, it's utterly consistent with human nature, and it's utterly consistent with the history of the papacy, the history of the cardinalate. This is what you have holy men in office as a check balance against, right? This sort of thing is quite obvious, actually, as an eventuality. You know, when you get bad men in high places, it doesn't have to be Pope. You get this all throughout the history of the church. So people are really, even older people I talk to in the church seem to have a real quixotic kind of naive stance with regard to human nature. This is just history. This is why history repeats itself. Why does history repeat itself in and out of the church? Because human nature is the same. People seem to really bought the Marxist assumption that there's no such thing as human nature, which would make the repetitions, you know, the sinusoidal up and down structure of history, it would make it surprising. Of course it's surprising unless human nature is fake. So it's an important thing that I teach the kiddos when we go through church history is this is nothing new now. It was nothing new in 800. It started right with the beginning of the church when it got powerful.
Yeah. All right. So, I'll just finish out this history for us. So in the 9th century, Pope Stephen V decreed that all 7 cardinal bishops were bound to sing Mass on rotation at the high altar at St. Peter's Basilica, one every Sunday. So what this tells us is sometime between 769 and 816, we have the introduction of cardinal bishops. And these are the bishops that are suburban or that orbit the city of Rome. Right, mm-hmm. So the neighboring bishops have now become cardinal bishops. So we have cardinal deacons originally, then we added cardinal priests, and here, after Charlemagne, 816, 817, the neighboring bishops become cardinal bishops, and they are required to come to Rome and sing High Mass on the altar at St. Peter's. So basically the church is trying to incorporate these neighboring bishops into the liturgical and official offices and works of papal Rome.
What was that year? 818? Was Charlemagne...
816, 817.
1617. Charlemagne ended up dying in the year 814. So you can see a lot of this stuff began the year before him, and you had eventualities the year right, you know, 2 years after he died. So it was bound up with this central figure of the middle ages.
Exactly. And this move to me seems to want to literally insulate the papacy, insulate the cardinals with episcopal bishop power around Rome. It makes it more Italian, in my viewpoint. Do you agree with that?
What will make it even more Italian in the sense of anyone like you or me who have spent time in Rome? You know, there's this word they're very proud of. It's like political Machiavellianism with a distinctly Rome spin, with a distinctly ecclesial spin, Church of Rome spin, is this concept of Romanita, right?
Yeah.
This begins here. You could make the case that it begins, not to accelerate you, but I think what is the conclaves of cardinals electing popes begins about two or three centuries after this, I think. That's really when you could say it. Yeah. That's where the Romanita is getting heightened in terms of embracing the Machiavellian nature of the way that things are done. That's the way things are done.
Right.
People love saying that. You call something corrupt in this world and people want to tell you that's just the way things are done. It's like, well, they're done corrupt in a corrupt fashion because corrupt people fashion it that way.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So moving along here, 1059, Pope Nicholas II. He's the one who explicitly states that the cardinal bishops, those that insulate Rome, are allowed by right to vote.
Right.
All right. And then there's the interesting, he also adds, this is a papal bull called In Nomine Domini, in the name of the Lord, that emperors cannot nominate candidates.
Oh, right.
Because that was obviously happening. You know, we're now over 200 years past Charlemagne.
Right.
Right. And they can't veto the winner. However, and this is kind of interesting, emperors can still confirm the election. And the election must take place in the city of Rome. It's kind of interesting.
That's interesting.
That means according to Nicholas, you can't have elections in Avignon or pizza or some other place. It has to be in Rome.
That is interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Foreshadows the Great Western Schism in Avignon.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It also states that the Pope is the Pope at the moment of election and not from his coronation or enthronement. So when he accepts and he says, I accept the election, he is Pope then.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because not all of them were yet bishops. Sometimes they were still priests or deacons at this point. And then they had to get consecrated a bishop. But their papacy begins at the moment of the election.
Yep. Very interesting.
Yeah, it is. This is why sometimes when you look in the dates of pontificates, they're a little bit confusing. Because sometimes they write down the date of the coronation. Sometimes they write the date of the election. So historians debate these things. At the Third Lateran Council, this is 1179, the right to the whole body of cardinals, bishops, priests, and deacons to elect the Pope was reestablished, and a new rule, 2/3 majority was required for a valid election. This is 1179. We get 2/3 majority.
Sounding very congressional.
It really is, yeah. And in 1244, Pope Innocent IV said that all cardinals can wear a red hat.
Oh.
So I didn't know that only comes at 1244.
Sounds early to me. I mean,
we hear the story of St. Bonaventure, how he got the red hat and they brought it to him, and he, as a humble friar, was in the kitchen washing the pots and pans. And so they brought him the red hat, and he says, they said, Bonaventure needs to come out. The Pope sent him a gift. And he said, he can't. He's telling the Pope. He's like, well, he's in there washing the pots. And he says, my hands are all oily. I can't touch it yet. They had to wait. It's a Franciscan tale that shows that Bonaventure was such a humble guy. You know, when he got the red hat, he was scrubbing greasy pots.
Well, that's funny.
So you sometimes see like Bonaventure with the red hat, but he's not wearing it. It's like off to the side.
That's funny.
But that would have been during his life, because Thomas Aquinas died in, 1274?
74, right.
So the red hat was a new thing.
Wasn't Aquinas going to the Fourth Lateran Council when he died, or something like that? Is that right?
The fourth was in 1215, so maybe it was the fifth or sixth. Can't remember.
Okay. I thought maybe I just made that up.
Okay, so... Let's see here. The number of cardinals has changed. It was originally just like 70 or 72, because Moses had 70 or 72 elders, that advised him. So that was kind of the idea. Sixtus V, who was Pope in the late 1500s, he capped the number of cardinals at 70. He said there are 6 cardinal bishops, 50 cardinal priests, and 14 cardinal deacons. 70 and 70 alone can vote for the Pope.
Wow. And those were those, was that proportion of cardinal bishops, cardinal priests, cardinal deacons set also, or was that accidental?
Yes. There was only 6 cardinal bishops, only 50 cardinal priests, and only 14 cardinal deacons. Sixtus the Fifth.
Right.
Yeah. And that corresponds with the number in the Old Testament that assisted Moses.
Got it.
And during the pontificate of John the 23rd, he actually allowed the number to go a little bit higher. So he didn't observe that rule. I guess as Pope, he can do what he wants to do.
Yeah.
And in 1965, Pope Paul VI increased the number of cardinal bishops by also including every patriarch of the Eastern Catholic churches.
Oh, wow. Oh, so he's the first one to include the Eastern patriarchs.
Paul VI.
How many of those were there?
At that time, I don't know. Not that many.
Yeah, there's not. Yeah, I know there aren't too many. Just
and I know
the
Eastern
seas.
Catholics are conflicted on this. Some of them say, well, it's about time the Eastern Catholics got to vote.
Right.
Well, okay, I kind of get that. But I mean, Romans don't come and vote on the Eastern conclaves for their patriarchs, you know? And also, some Eastern Catholics think it's bad that the Eastern patriarchs wear a red hat of the Roman Church as basically a cleric of the Church of Rome.
Really?
They think that is kind of like a contradiction. Yeah.
I don't know, though. I mean, that's sort of cross-fertilized by the Orthodox notion of what the Pope is, you know, just first among equals.
Right.
If truly the Bishop of Rome is, if we're looking at the org chart of the Roman Church, not to be too corporation-like.
Yeah, I mean,
the Pope is over them, then it makes sense that they have a say.
Exactly.
Would be my
but
first
see,
thought.
A lot of Eastern Catholics are like, we don't like that. That makes if the patriarch wears a red hat, that's explicitly defining the org chart, and we don't like that.
Right.
So some Eastern Catholics I've met say it's about time. We love that Paul VI did this. Some Eastern Catholics say, man, it looks really bad to the Eastern Orthodox because they're basically wearing I belong to the Church of Rome pin on their lapel.
Yeah, name badge.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got it.
So I don't know. Let us know in the comments what you think. I don't really know. In 1970, and I think this is pernicious is too strong of a word. I think it is seems to me to be an abuse for the College of Cardinals. Paul VI raised the number of cardinal electors from 70, which is the traditional number, to 120 electors, which immediately gave him the power to name 50 more of his own choice.
Right.
And at the same time said that all cardinals that were 80 or older cannot vote, which effectively killed all the cardinals appointed by Pius the 11th, Pius the 12th, all John the 20th, all. So basically, that was to me, that's an ecclesiastical coup. I mean, you come in and you say, I'm raising the number from 70 to 50. I'm picking all those 50. And oh, by the way, if you're an older guy from preemie, you can't vote now. What do you think about that, Tim?
Well, I mean, we've talked about the rule of 80-year-olds not being able to vote. That by itself is an ecclesial coup, but because it just says anybody before probably John the 23rd, you're out. Anybody under Pius the 12th or before that was incardinated, you're donezo in terms of having a voting voice in the church, which is huge. I did not know that. Oh, we should start calling Paul the VI like FDR. Remember with FDR's court packing threat. You know, I mean, if you raise the number of Supreme Court justices from 9 to a similar proportion would be 15.
Yeah.
And 9 to 15.
And then you have mandatory resignation based on a number.
Right. We're going to do mandatory resignation. I mean, I guess what it would be is FDR and whatever that was, 31 or 32. when the New Deal wasn't going through because the previous court, this was still a holdover from the Lochner era court, was shutting it down. He was like, okay, I'll just pack the court then unless you start doing what I want to do. Yeah. 70 to 120 is this, I think, exact same, close to the exact same proportion as nine SCOTUS justices to 15. If he'd threatened to do 15, six additional ones, and all the old guys, let's say it's a slight majority of the original nine, can't vote, it's basically a new court. Exactly. So I didn't, we've talked about what Paul VI did, strike one. I did not know that he is the one that brought it to 120. And now it's above that, isn't it? Isn't it above 120 today?
So basically what Paul VI has done here is he's now created, and this is what I want to talk to you about in the show when we talk about corrupt popes too, is he's now created a two-tier college of cardinals. The guys who are over 80 are cardinal, but they functionally do nothing. It's honorific.
Right.
And then you have the guys who are under 80 and they vote. So what they've done now in the post-conciliar church is you can only have 120 under 80 who are electors, papal cardinal electors, and then you can have infinity number of guys over 80.
Oh, is that who made that rule?
Paul
who
VI.
Changed that?
Paul
that was
VI.
Paul VI also?
Yeah, he did this whole remix on the unprecedented that's, in the history of the church.
That's wild. Yeah. Okay, see, this is...
And no one talks
adds,
about this. Everybody's like, Paul VI, the new mass, Paul VI, the new mass. Look, I mean, this is, to me, like one of the biggest things ever happened in church history. No one ever talks about it.
Yeah, no one does talk about this. Trads, any group within the Trads, you know, obviously Novus Ordo, sort of neocons. I just never heard this story, aside from... Mm-hmm. Aside from the limited research we've done here,
folks.
That's big.
You heard it here. So
that's surprising.
Currently, this could be a little bit old, but there's currently 224 living cardinals, 124 are electors. So Francis is bumped up over four over. So he actually, if he dies right now, there'll be 124 electors.
But look how many dinosaurs that means. That's like 100 over 80s.
No, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
100 living cardinals right now cannot vote. Correct.
That's weird.
Yeah. So that's where we're at right now. And I want to talk about, you know, now we have, you know, this problem of bad cardinals. There's always been your Cardinal Richelieu and your, you know, from Three Musketeers and, you know,
right.
Cardinals who, I heard Cardinal Richelieu, he would, you know, priests would say the divine office, the breviary every day. On pain of mortal yeah. sin. So I heard yeah. he would just take a week off and he would do the entire breviary in a week for the whole year.
Oh,
that way
really?
He'd have the whole year free. Yeah. That's what I heard. He's like, hey, but, I said the breviary for the year.
But why do that? I thought they're supposed to do it. You mean not just the sections. You mean he would do all of his days.
Yeah, he would be like January 1st is breviary is this. And like an hour or two later, he'd do January 2nd. He would just do it all. Anyway, bad cardinals is the next thing, but I want before I hand the mic to you, Tim, and we talk about bad cardinals, I just want to say that we have seen in Paul VI the wedding cake of the cardinals now has two layers, right? Cardinal electors and cardinal fogies that can't
right.
do anything over 80,
right.
which in the history of the church we've not ever seen. And then in Francis, we've seen the council of cardinals, and these are the C9 or now the C6. And they actually have direct access to the Pope.
Right.
Other cardinals, like Cardinal Burke, don't, apparently.
What?
There's the inner circle. I call this the College of the College of Cardinals. It's like the Holy of Holies.
Right.
And like so now we have a triple. The wedding cake
yeah.
has the third tier. And this
right.
is pernicious. And a priest, I can't remember the book. Maybe someone can remind me, but said that Malachi Martin prophesied that in the future, popes, in order to have more power, would begin to have another inner cardinal circle that
right.
would hold the real power that the other cardinals would be left out of. This way he can bring all the power of his friends into one group. And I think we've seen that in Francis, the C9. So I guess before we talk about C9 and Cardinal Pell and everything going on in the news, let's talk about recent appointments of the cardinals we got now. What you got, Tim?
Well, I mean, it's almost monolithic when you look at this list. It's monolithically, you know, Joannine Paulinen created. It's all JP2. His fingerprints are all over all of. If you complain, how did this guy become a cardinal? It's from John Paul II. There are a couple from Benedict, who's our most recent pope, which would create the natural assumption that the most recent pope, currently not sitting, was the great creator. But of course, he had a pontificate lasting not quite 9 years. JP2 had the pontificate lasting, you know, almost three times that. But I mean, you start going through this list.
Let me jump in, Tim. Not only how do we get a cardinal like that, the bigger question that I hear from people is, who elected Bergoglio? How did that happen? And we just have to grant that the men that were selected by John Paul II and by Benedict XVI to be cardinals who wore the red hat favored at least 2/3. The numbers, the rumors are that it's more than 2/3 voted for Bergoglio. They love it. They wanted it.
Right.
And maybe there's buyer's regret now, but at the time, the right-hand men of John Paul II and the right-hand men of B16 voted for Bergoglio. We just have to accept that fact.
Well, maybe there, before we go further, this is something that we've heard a lot the last 4 years. Maybe there's buyer's remorse now, and maybe there's not. That's very, very difficult to ascertain. I mean, this pontificate has been a slow burn train wreck, right? You know, a train wreck happening in slow motion where all the pain is felt in real time. But other than that, you're watching it in slow motion. And so the half sane, like maybe moderates who elected him are probably tempted to say something like what you just said. Well, we have buyer's remorse. We didn't know. But I wonder how authentic that is. I mean, if you're extreme enough to have been a cardinal elector of one Mario Bergoglio from Buenos Aires.
Jorge.
Remember, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, that's right. Then you are easily in the cadre of people that I would characterize as extremist. And again, there's no October surprise in the election of Bergoglio. He was known, remember, back in 1996, that early, even though the rest of the world didn't know him, even knowledgeable lay people. He was known as the one guy that can do the bidding, that's extreme enough to do the bidding of the Sankt Gallen Mafia. So they knew, even though most of his cohorts probably didn't know who he was. So it bears mention, right? It bears mention that these guys know who they might not all know one another personally, but we don't understand how that works. Same as I don't know how it really works after the Senate floor meetings. I think they're going and getting coffee across the aisle. That's strangely disconcerting. But and I'm sure they do that too in Rome. You probably know more about that. But the point is, they know one another's ecclesial politics, you know, because they've all been bishop for a long time. So don't people out there that are listening to this research we're about to adduce here. I mean, it is what it is. And all these guys have been high ups in their region, you know, in their own countries for a long time. These guys were handpicked by usually chanceries even to be bishop. I mean, handpicked, they're groomed up through their chanceries and picked bishop by Rome.
You've got a seminarian who's working hard and he's a yes man and he does what he's supposed to do. Okay, send him to the NAC, you know, North American College in Rome. He gets into the Romanitas, learns Italian. He's got a leg up on all of his seminarian brothers back home. He comes back. He's maybe a pastor. He works in the chancery. And, you know, like a lot of these cardinals, if you look at their history, they've only been pastor for less than 5 years. Most of their life of these big shot hierarchs have been in chanceries. I mean, it's working in the diocese.
Right.
Right. So they've been groomed from the beginning for these positions. A lot of them from seminary.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, just listen to some of these appointments by John Paul II to the cardinalate. You ready to go through this?
Let's do it. Roll call.
So there's no one in his first consistory when, you know, which consistory is like a reverse conclave. Conclave is when the cardinals elect the pope. The consistory is when the pope gets together and nominates new cardinals. That sticks out to me, and that might just be lacunae in my own knowledge of personnel. But no one, they're all, probably most of them are dead. Most or all of them are dead, and I didn't know any of them as extreme mafia type leftists. But even as early as JP2's second consistory, which is, you know, like 1980 or something like that. Let me get the date on this. I'm not going to do the date for all of them. But his second consistory literally hails to 1980.
Okay.
83.
That late? 83?
Yeah, went from 79 was his first consistory to 83.
Wow, you didn't make any cardinals in 3 years.
Four years, yeah. But so in 83, he elevated.
You know why I bet that is?
Huh.
Because Paul VI already stacked it.
Yeah, yeah.
It was probably full because Paul VI brought out the 120 and he put all his guys in. So, you know, all the 80.
That's true. But then I'm surprised that there's one in 79. He did one right away, right? Almost. I mean, yeah. It's just that jumps off the page.
We'll leave that to other people to research.
Yeah, yeah. Better men, better if men. You can find any.
There we go.
Which you can't, but don't hold your breath. So second consistory was Bernardine and Martini. I mean, two of the honchos. That's early. I mean, those are like maybe the two worst names I could.
To me, that's like. Bernardine is the Western villain and Martini is the Eastern villain.
Legit. That's what it's like. And that's so right away. I mean, this isn't a.
That's nominating like Penguin and Joker, the same conclave.
Yeah. Yeah. and Riddler's coming.
And Riddler's on the way.
I mean, so just bear in mind. The background thought should be, this ain't a red pill on John Paul II video. People are asking us to do that, but you know, that should be somewhere in the,
and I know
have the presence
I know
of mind.
Martini by the 80s had already rejected Humanae Vitae.
Oh, he rejected it right away.
It was obvious public knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But well, I think Bernardine had as well. Yeah. I mean,
Bernardine, folks, is the guy who brought us the seamless garment.
And
argument that we talked a lot on the show about is, you know, anything that has to do with human life is equal and on par to talk about abortion.
Right.
So you need to vote for a Democrat who provides housing for poor people. That's just as important as trying to stop abortion.
Wasn't Bernardine directly connected to the Chicago Saul Alinsky Catholic machine? I might
Everybody
be wrong.
Says
there,
so,
but
yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
Malachi Martin says that was a hub of Satanism in the church, in the hierarchy. If you follow Malachi Martin, I don't follow him all the way, but those are rumors that
even,
pederasty
even if you do
Satanism.
Follow him all the way, you don't admit it. And, I mean, everyone, I've suggested this in a few different of our videos here. Go look at the EWTN very well-made documentary called Wolf in Sheep's Clothes, all about how very thoroughly, very thoroughgoingly, Saul Alinsky infiltrated the Chicago church and really anyone associated with Chicago between like 1950 and or 19, I think even the late 40s and like 1970 knows and was.
How about today? Till today?
Through today. But he was active in Chicago, the church. Yeah. The church was like his primary. It's much more direct than you think. It's not just, oh, both Hillary and Obama were Alinskyites. It's like the church. I mean, what's his name? Father Mitch Pacwa worked for a subsidiary group of Alinsky.
He says back before he knew it was up, to the credit of Mitch Pacwa. We're not saying Mitch Pacwa is an Alinskyite, but I think he's a good guy.
He figured it out. He figured it out and he renounced it and all that. But, you know, I don't know. One likes to think of oneself as having instinct. It's this term I always talk about is, if you use the term instinct, whether it's a coach or a teacher or a parent, or you're talking to your peers, it means you're punting on something, right? It means you're like, mm-hmm. this is some skill I'm identifying in this person that I'm saying has this instinct, and I don't want to find out exactly what the metaphysics of that skill is. I'm just going to punt. You'd like to think you have instinct on. Saul Alinsky, I don't think, was as subtle as some people say, but
right.
whatever. Yeah, he didn't know at the time. Third conclave, or third consistory, rather, you get Cardinal Law is the work product.
Who, you know, Law was considered to be a super conservative, but we all realized he wasn't.
Right.
And he turns out to be a really good buddy of McCarrick. Go right. back and watch my interview with James Grine to hear more on that. So, yeah.
On Law specifically?
Law, yeah. Law and McCarrick are buds. Yeah. In fact, it was McCarrick who provided shelter for Law when he was in trouble with the Neumeier has shown this, that when he was in trouble, when Law, before they deported him to Rome, McCarrick is the one who gave him hiding down in D.C.
Oh, really? Yeah.
They're buddies. Yeah.
Fourth consistory. So, I mean, you don't have the stacking of bad names in these early consistories, but you have some really key Sunk-Gallen Mafia types. Fourth consistory, you get Silvestrini, who's a Sunk-Gallen member, yep. card-carrying member.
See our video on Sunk-Gallen Mafia for more details.
Right. I mean, there aren't that many of these guys, and pretty much every early consistory, you're getting one or two from JP2, nominated by JP2. And these are the guys that are really the mortal enemies of JP2's right-hand man. So there's a conflict of interest here, right?
Right.
Of Benedict the 16th and the, more importantly, the program of Benedict the 16th, the goals, the agenda. This again, throws a little shade on the notion that Benedict and JP2 had really one and the same agenda, concomitants between their pontificates. I don't buy that.
I don't
so
either. The longer we live in the pontificate of Francis, the more I see that there's a disconnect between the pontificate of John Paul II and Benedict the 16th.
And I see more of a connect, to use the same noun form, between JP2 and Francis, with a weird blip, almost inexplicable blip there with the Benedict pontificate. Though it's not so inexplicable when you consider the Sunk-Gallen Mafia, which everything points back to, is that they were trying to go directly from JP2
right.
to Francis, to what would have been the Francis Bergoglio, which was at the 2004 conclave.
A Martini or a Bergoglio, that's what they wanted.
Sure, but I mean, who came in second in the voting in 2004? That's Bergoglio. Again, I'll never be over this fact. It's Bergoglio, which no one even knew who he was.
Say that for the people listening, that Bergoglio was the runner-up, second place in the conclave that chose B16.
Right, and other cardinals, he came in second in 2004. He just made it on to like the international scene a cup within, I think it was after 2000. I didn't even think he was an archbishop for very long. The ink was still drying. And a bunch of the cardinals that said it was like the second or third vote where he made a rush with the English cardinals. I read an account of this in L'Osservatore Romano the day after Benedict got in, and they're like, yeah, some unknown from like South America made a rush at the second to last vote. And he nearly overtook the presumptive Pope, you know, Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger. And several cardinals remarked on how strange this was. And it came from nowhere. And it was a bunch of English and Irish cardinals that I don't know what to make
yeah,
of that.
Yeah, I mean, that would be Hume and Murphy O'Connor.
Right, sure. who were famous canvassers,
right.
which
and
is
probably what's his name O'Brien, who exempted himself because of sexual abuse.
Oh, right. Is he an American though?
No,
O'Brien.
Well, there is an O'Brien American, but there's also the O'Brien who didn't vote because
right.
of his scandals,
his proclivities.
No.
I mean, it's really odd. That's the point that you get. I mean, the easiest way to tie this back together is every consistory, like I originally said, you're getting one of these Sunk-Gallen members, and you know, it's like the favor ended up being repaid. But these are early, remember? So yes, we all know about the Parkinson's with regard to the JP2 narrative. I'm not forgetting it. No, I'm addressing it. This is still early. This is still 80s, you know, in these consistories. The fifth consistory, you get, listen to this, Sedano. Oof. Cardinal Sedano and Cardinal Mahoney. Come on. Oh. It's brutal. Bad. These are early. These are still the first half of his consistory.
That's like a 1-2 punch to the kidneys right there. Both sides.
It is.
Boom.
It is. Both. Sedano, remember, is implicated by Archbishop V. He came out looking very, very bad. Bertone also was implicated by Archbishop Vigano. And these are also the two main culprits, as the story emerges with the cover-up of the third secret, the second part of the third secret of Fatima, as we call it, 3B. Sedano and Bertone were both, Bertone hasn't been implanted yet by JP2 until a later consistory, but both these guys are JP2 creatures, and they were both arguably not my favorite. And Sedano has found more favor, I think, with Francis than Bertone. But they were the two kind of only two villains, if there have to be two, named by Antonio Socci in his Fatima cover-up book. So, but I mean, Mahoney, enough said, right? Res ipsa loquitur.
Yeah, the greatest abuse payouts in the history of Christianity of all time. We covered that in a previous video under Mahoney.
My archdiocese here, biggest see in the world, or just the United States.
What's crazy is his scandal was way bigger than Law's, but Law got crucified, and Mahoney, no one ever talks to him. Mahoney was on the floor of the USCCB a month ago. It's ridiculous.
I know.
Mahoney's a criminal. I know.
He's a criminal. He's allowed to stick around. And
it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Every Catholic layperson in America should be raising a fist saying, get Mahoney out of here.
Right. Not just people like me within 100 miles of LA, where I'm at right now. Like, I mean, everyone. He's up there with you know, the scandal mongers that have found favor.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the end of the fifth consistory. Then the sixth consistory, you have Yves Congar. I mean, he was really well known. I think with the sixth consistory, we break into the 90s, maybe late 80s, early 90s. Seventh consistory.
Well, I just want to say something about Congar. He's a nouvelle théologie, and we'll do a video on nouvelle théologie, the new theology that emerges in the 40s and 50s, and ultimately are the seeds that become what we see in the 60s, 70s, 80s. But he's definitely a champion of that nouvelle théologie, the new theology, the corruption. And what this shows is that John Paul II has a sympathy for that school of thought.
Right. Another, since we're doing Congar lore, another thing that I've heard several times over, I think it was a direct admission by Congar, printed admission, don't quote me there, is that during the council, 62 to 65, And this is illustrative because it shows what a libs club the council was. You know, whether or not the documents are bad, that's immaterial to what I'm saying. They hated, you know, the arch nemesis at the council, kind of the proto Ratzinger figure, was Cardinal Ottaviani, you know, the CDF, hated conservative. Congar would brag that every night of the first year or two of the council, he would go and he would say, in his own words, he would piss on the doorstep of Ottaviani. Yeah. So these are the holy men entrusted with the you know, the mantle of the apostles. And you have this just...
And for Ottaviani, people always make fun of the way I say it. I don't care. I'm from Texas. he was friends with Lefebvre, the founder of SSPX.
That's right.
They were buddies. They worked together at the council. Also, they turned his mic off while he was speaking at Vatican II.
Congar was behind that. It's called the Ottaviani intervention.
Yes. Where literally, was Congar the guy at the mixer turning down the volume or what?
He's associated with it. It was him and three or four other guys, I believe. I mean, I've always heard Congar. Congar hated Ottaviani.
Yeah.
Ottaviani's a good, holy old gentleman of the old order. He could have been in the curia of Leo the 13th or Gregory the 16th, the guys we like, people out there who aren't as equipped with the personnel. And imagine this, he's crippled. He's over 80 at the council, but he's CDF, so it doesn't matter. He's broken down. Is he blind? I think he's blind by that time. He's either blind or deaf. I think he's blind. And they literally, he's talking at this intervention where he's saying, people, we can't get ahead of ourselves. This is getting wild. You guys are getting carried away, which the conservatives at the council at BC2 were saying this. And they pulled out the mic on him. The indignity, right? And they're laughing. Imagine the same guys that are doing this are, quote, pissing on his doorstep every night. Yeah. You can imagine. And they're meeting, at night. The bad guys are meeting at the Greg, doing what they call their own words, shadow council. Mm-hmm. So when you start hearing the backstory, or everyone read The Rome Flows into the Tiber. It's an amazing account of this. It's an eye opener. So then you're like, oh, all this stuff that Marshall and Gordon have been saying about like weaponized ambiguity for going even back to the documents of the council. Maybe they're fine. We argue they are fine dogmatically, but now this makes more sense. So it's a big boy, not just a boys club, a liberal boys club, with many infiltrators there. And look at how they're treating the purported conservatives, or the reputed conservatives, I should say. Yeah. And it's wild men doing shadow counsel and really harassing their opponents. These are the guys, that we're making reference to. And Congar, this was all known. Remember, I mean, JP2, the young Wojtyla, I get people make fun of the way I say
Wojtyla.
Wojtyla, I don't think anyone's saying it right, but
guys, part of our show is Marshall and Gordon just say everything how they want to say it. We just don't know.
My mentor.
We have to say Polish names, and we have to say Italian names, and German names, and Asian names, and Filipino names. We're bound to get these wrong. But here's the
thing: you got to own it. Like, we're American. Like my mentor at the Greg, who was going to do my dissertation advisory stuff. One of the greatest Thomists in the world, and he is a Jesuit. He's a faithful Jesuit, Father Kevin Flannery. He would go through our Aristotle metaphysics class, and it's in Italian, and he spoke perfect Italian, but he just, he would go through it without any kind of affected attempt at no American.
He'd say,
K.O. Mencionato, as I mentioned earlier. I love it.
People are always dissing us on Vegano. Like, we were reporting it within 24 hours.
Yeah.
And all the original stuff didn't have the accent on the O. It was just coming out, People weren't accenting it.
No, I know. But when you go to order a taco or a burrito, it's a taco or a burrito, exactly. not some trill of the tongue.
Yeah. And when you say Caesar, you say, well, they actually pronounced it Kaiser in the early days. Well, I know that.
Right.
Who cares?
Who cares? I'm married.
Before you move on, I want to read this excerpt from Vatican II on Ottaviani. Ready? While Ottaviani kept speaking, Alfric signaled to a technician who switched off the microphone. After tapping the microphone to determine it was off, the half-blind Ottaviani stumbled back to his seat in humiliation, while there was scattered applause in the council hall by members of the council fathers who held that he had gone on too long. End quote.
Scattered applause. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're clapping. Yeah. 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 And he's half blind. One eye was totally blind. From all accounts, Congar was partly behind that. Yeah. But from all accounts I've ever read. Okay. So let's just get through this list, shall we? So Cardinal Schönborn is at the 7th. People used to.
Everybody thought he was a great conservative, but he's come out for women's ordination and sketchy things on divorce and remarriage and communion.
I really got familiar with Schönborn at the two synods, 2014 and 2015, where he was just the ultimate champ of what Cardinal Casper wanted to do, which became what Francis wanted to do. Those two are basically substitutable for one another. And who ultimately presented the apostolic constitution, Amoris Laetitia? It was Sean Bourne. He presented it, and Francis said, this is a special honor. And he's such a whiz at theology, Francis said, and I'm not it. So I'm having, he checked it out for me. Remember, Francis stepped around Cardinal Mueller, the CDF at the time, to go to, you know, another German speaker, Cardinal Schönborn. And he said, no, remember Mueller said, no, I never even had a look at the draft.
Right.
Of Amoris Laetitia. Guess who did? It was Schönborn. He presented it, and he started immediately the day he presented it attacking anyone who impugned the uprightness of Amoris Laetitia. So Schönborn's no conservative. I told some of my buddies I work with that back in 2014, and they'd all been totally convinced, because he would present at the Napa conference out here year after year. I'm like, that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
You know, all the paradigms have changed on these guys.
Precisely.
But anyway, so Schönborn, then with the Eighth Consistory, I think this is getting to early mid 90s now, Cardinal Bergoglio is made. He's a made man now, and things seem to be rolling towards fate. Fate is, you know, amor fati. You got to love what happens, because we are now rolling toward the inevitability of a Bergoglio papacy. In the Ninth Consistory, ooh, look at this one. This, you're going to like this one. This is good. This got, you're going to get excited. You get, hold applause, please. You get Cardinal Maradiaga, Cardinal Casper, Cardinal Napier of Africa, one of the few, I think, bad African ones. Maybe I'm wrong on that. But you get Murphy O'Connor, another. You get Liman, another Sunk Gallen Mafia mafioso. Yep. So that one more time.
God, what year was this?
So in the ninth, this is late. This is middle night. I mean, you might be able to use this your worm tongue hypothesis.
Kill here. Shot, man.
It is a kill shot. I mean, look at all of the C9. Okay, everyone I'm about to read is either C9 or
Sunk Gallen Mafia.
Or Gallen Mafia. Maradiaga, Casper. Well, Casper actually wasn't either Sunk Gallen, or he's like...
No, he's Sunk Gallen.
He is Sunk Gallen.
Yeah, he's Sunk Gallen.
So Maradiaga, is Sunk Gallen.
This is 2001. I just looked it up.
Oh, okay. So this is late. Admittedly, this is late. I thought it was 99. Maradiaga, Casper, McCarrick,
who's
sort of like the original Sunk Gallen, Murphy O'Connor, and Liman. All of them are Sunk Gallen mafiosi.
And that's 2001? That is like served up on a platter right there.
And it's set up because, and maybe I actually buy here that it's a worm tongue thing, because he was pretty sick in 2001.
You see him at the Jubilee in 2000, and he's pretty, John Paul II.
Broke down.
He's invalid and broke down, yeah. So 2001, there's definitely some worm tongue infiltration, and they just stacked it in 01, didn't they?
Well, they stacked it because they knew that the conclave was coming. 01, 02, 03, 04.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're like, okay, so we are going to get Cardinal Bergoglio in. Remember, they'd said from 1996 they wanted Bergoglio. We need him to do all the evil stuff we want to do. And they didn't end up getting it. We now know with the luxury of history. But look at, they were stacking the ninth. And look at the 10th isn't actually as bad. I think they knew they had it with 9th, but they got Peter Turkson from Africa. Again, one of the bad Africans. There aren't too many bad African cardinals. Right. Most of those guys are legit. Like
Cardinal Sarah's good, yeah.
Sarah's amazing. Orense is amazing. You get Bertone in the 10th, is made a cardinal. He's been around doing stuff for a long time.
Right.
But you get Pell in the 10th,
who was just as of convicted yesterday or day before as of the recording of this, and removed from the Pope's C9.
Right.
Okay.
He was the only putative conservative on the Pope's C9, but whatever that's worth,
whatever he's nowadays.
And then Yeah, and then Ouellette. Yeah, right. The paradigms have changed.
Ouellette, who everybody thought was this arch conservative, but Ouellette came out hard against Vigano.
Right.
And Vigano had then responded to Ouellette, because Ouellette goes on to be the head of the Congregation for Bishops.
Right.
So he's the guy basically appointing bishops on behalf of Pope Francis.
Right.
Before. That's another key pick. Yeah. So, but man, that 2001 consistory, that is a kill shot, man.
It was. What was the setup? They thought he was going to die probably that year. So yeah. They're like, let's get it fresh. And then we'll go. I mean, that's the interesting thing, the way that consistories interplay with conclaves. There's no check or balance there. The Pope makes cardinals at consistories, and then the cardinals, you could literally have the Pope making all of these four or five really wicked guys at the 2001 consistory, you making them into cardinals, and then later that year, those cardinals making a new pope out of one of themselves in, you know, the next day. So consistories and conclaves have a mutual constitution, a mutual constitutivity that doesn't bear any checks and balances that we Americans expect because of, you know, vertical and horizontal federalism that we're so accustomed to, which just makes sense. There's none of that. Right. I mean, they thought they were going to get this done in 2004. The St. Gallen Mafia, they didn't end up getting it done in 2004, but they got it done in 2013.
Yeah. So here we stand now, just for a breakdown, 14% of cardinal electors today were appointed by JP2. 38% of cardinal electors today were appointed by B16, Ben XVI. And currently 48% of the cardinal electors are appointed by Francis. So we're 2% away from Francis having a 50%. But it's interesting, in Francis's short pontificate up until today, he's already appointed 47.6% of the cardinals. So he's in the consistories, he's been very quick and very generous in appointing a lot of cardinal electors.
Well, remember the consistory that he canceled? I think it was right after it was like 2 days, if memory serves, after the publication of the Dubia in November of 2016.
Yes.
There was a consistory that he canceled. It was canceled, and he'd made so many cardinals, I think, earlier in that year that he was like, I don't need to do this. And this would just create more negative news after the Dubia, I think is what it was. But yeah, he has been aggressive.
And people say, we'll get, you know, when this pope does, we'll get a new pope. But remember, of the old cardinals, this is 14% of John Paul II and 38% of, they voted for Bergoglio. So you've got those guys, and then you've also got the 48% that Francis himself chose. So it's already stacked for a Francis 2.0.
Right. We're always trying to say have hope, but there is no hope for the next conclave short of divine intervention.
Yeah, some kind of intervention, yeah.
Because these are all his. And here's the thing, people. I don't know what else you had to say, but for me, it's a closing thought. We should close on this. What the left does, and I don't think there's any more this late in the game, reasonable distinction between religious left and political left. It's all the same stuff. It's all Peronism. And I know people like to say that's right-wingism. It's not. It's just Machiavellian politics. That's the left. Let's say this. It's all Alinsky. Here's what you have to admire in your foe, like Sun Tzu said. The left always, they get you down and then they step on your neck. Like Kobe Bryant said, you got to be a close. You got to have the killer instinct. You got to play to win.
Kill shot.
They play to win. Yeah, do the kill shot. You got to get them down.
And Karate step Kid, on the neck. Sweep the leg.
Sweep the leg. That's right. In Karate Kid, take them out in a body bag, as he yells.
Yeah.
You know, whereas the good guys, they're just sissies. And this is what we're really trying to do away with. You got to play to win.
You got to be the Maccabee. You got to be the Maccabee.
Right. Because
you got to have a goal. We are taking back the temple and the altar.
Right.
Here's the game plan. Let's do it. And they did it.
So take no prisoners. If I mean, you're playing to win, so you wanna get up by, you know, four points in a basketball game, then you wanna hit the nail in the coffin with hit a three or something. Like, some guys have killer instinct, like Kobe or Jordan. Some guys, however good they might be, this is another pet project of mine. I think deep. LeBron James here, no killer instinct. It is. You, and this is LeBron, as much as I dislike the player and the man, LeBron James, we conservatives are actually like LeBron James in this way. We don't have the killer instinct. We get a little, look at what conservatives thought they had in JP2. I think the narrative is largely misdirected now, but that's in retrospect. Look at what we thought we had in this long pontificate. Like, this is good enough. Meanwhile, he's doing all these favors for the leftists, setting up for generations to come a leftist church. He's doing it.
Yeah.
And you know,
started with Paul VI.
Yeah, started with Paul VI. So yeah, go back to your history. But I mean, he was doing things in conjunction with Paul VI, with John the 23rd, with these guys that were ostensibly on the other side. We just never get wins. I'm sick of it. We never get lasting victories on the right side of things.
Right. Yeah, we had our blip in B16. We're still trying to figure out how that all worked out. But I think, you know, as it stands today, the Francis kind of pulled one on us, and he made the Council of Nine. And now he's lost 3 members of it because of scandal and abuse. He's down to 6. And so there's egg on his face. You know, he has the triple cake, the councils, the electors, and the cardinal fogies who can't. I don't know what he's going to do now. You know, is he going to keep the council? Is he going to abolish it? Is he just going to replace, put 3 more guys in? Is Supich going to join the C9? That's what I think is going to happen. We'll wait.
When did he? We didn't talk as much about it as we thought we would, but I don't know what. When did he create the C9? I don't remember when he did that. I just remember it starting to be on LifeSite and 1 Peter 5 and all these.
2013, dude, a month after his election.
That's why I don't remember it. He wasn't on my totally on my radar yet.
He announced that he was going to create it 1 month after he was elected. So it's like one of the very first reforms of Francis. You got the College of Cardinals, and within that College of Cardinals, you have the Super Cardinals, the C9. So
I don't remember that.
That's part of the Francis agenda, and it's kind of, it looks like now it's like dead on arrival because of the scandals. But we'll have to see. We need to watch it closely and see how he either dismisses it or continues to use it.
But go back to the hard and fast rule of the universe, like the second law of thermodynamics. There's no beating it. Leftists play to win, right? These Machiavellian, you know, Alinskyites. They play to win. He'll replace them, or he'll just say it's the C6 now and proceed
right
as according to plan. You know, we are on schedule. They're always on schedule, these leftist guys. So, don't expect the Francis agenda, Francis the Humble's agenda, to be slowed down at all just because they've hit some speed bumps. Didn't stop them with Mahoney.
Yep.
Didn't stop them with McCarrick, right? And it's not going to stop them here.
Yep. All right. Well, people, don't lose hope. Remember, some of the greatest saints in our Catholic Church came from times of corruption. It's actually an opportunity for you to become a saint, to endure the sadness, the sorrow, the corruption, the lack of sanctity we see, the sex scandals, all these things that are coming out. This is a time for us to double up, follow the Catholic norms, regular confession, mass, daily mass if you can, find reverent masses, holiness. Check out the Latin Mass, right? Pray the rosary every day, as Our Lady asked at Fatima. Continue the Catholic norms with your family, with your friends, especially with your kids, your spouses. If you're a priest, encourage it in your parish. Bring back those norms. So thanks for watching. Please subscribe, hit the bell button, hit the like button. Anything else you want to say, Tim?
You always close it out strong. There's not a lot to add. Stay hopeful, but be a realist.
You
know, one pulls you up, the other pulls you down. You got to be real in your hopefulness, or else it's not a genuine, you know, one of the 3 virtues of the Holy Spirit. You got to be like, okay, this is what it is. That list should scare you. That list out there should which
that
is
list should make you say, maybe I shouldn't just do 5 decades of the rosary. Maybe right. I should start doing 10 or 15 decades of the rosary every day for the church and for the cardinals and for my pastors.
Right.
We got to double down. We got to work even harder now.
That's right.
By God's grace. All right, everybody, thanks so much for watching. We are out.